WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 70 points at 6,613. That's in record territory. The blue chips are up as investors buy shares of technology companies and others likely to benefit from a stronger economy. There are curbs on program trading on the New York Stock Exchange. Federal and state arrest warrants are out for former MGM owner Giancarlo Peretti. Bloomberg's Alexis Christophorus reports.
The Italian financier Giancarlo Peretti has skipped bail and fled the U.S. Peretti was scheduled to be sentenced in Delaware today. He faced as many as 10 years in prison for committing perjury in the case that cost him control of MGM. His lawyer says Peretti is in Italy. That's a violation of his bail. Peretti's extravagance quickly drove MGM to the brink of bankruptcy after he bought it from investor Kirk Kerkorian back in 1990. When the movie studio failed to pay its debts, it was taken over by the French bank Credit Lyonnais. I'm Alexis Christophorus.
The ongoing consolidation of the defense industry produced another merger today. Raytheon is buying the defense operations of Texas Instruments for nearly $3 billion in cash. Both firms are large producers of missiles, radar, and secret electronic systems for the Pentagon. Officials with the Federal Reserve Board seem confident that inflation will remain tame and that the U.S. economy will keep on its path of long-term growth. Federal Reserve Board Governor Lawrence Meyer told reporters he doesn't see a need now for a change in interest rates. He pointed to the low inflation rate and projections that the economy will expand between 2 and 2.5% this coming year. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember the composer Burton Lane. He died yesterday of a stroke. He was 84 and had been one of the last surviving composers of classic American popular song. Burton Lane left us with many great songs, including How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, How Are Things in Glaucomora, and You're My Thrill. Many of his songs were composed for movies, but he wrote some of his best-known melodies for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. I spoke with Burton Lane in 1990 when he was 77. He had just teamed up with singer Michael Feinstein to record the first volume of the Burton Lane songbook. The album opens with a song that Lane wrote with lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane at the piano. We'll hear the verse from that original demo, then segue into the recent recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls a-falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work we never shirk, in a happy land of tinsel and gauze. Because we like applause.
Burton Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I was received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you two names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old. And this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engaged in some trifling, just very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative. Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, I had to take one too.
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, Bert, play, and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, I'll do it if you sit alongside of me. So he was sitting facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, is this your son? And he said, yes. And she said, my name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back. And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for A Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remick's music publishing company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remick's, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me for on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, French Artaud. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
The song that was used for that movie, well, one of the songs that was used for that movie was Everything I Have Is Yours.
That's right.
Beautiful song. And who in the movie sang it?
It was sung by Arthur Jarrett, who was the current big singer, such as Bing Crosby was at that time. He had his own radio show, and he was the one who sang the song. And the song, everybody knows, Everything I Have Is Yours, You're Part of Me. I got a call one day shortly after the song was purchased, and I was asked if I could think of something for Joan Crawford to do in the song, because she was dancing with Clark Gable by the bandstand, and as she danced by, they wanted her to have something to sing. And I thought of a little phrase, da-da-da, da-da-da-da, which she hummed, and that became part of the song. And all the orchestrations that came out at that time, going back 1933, had that little phrase that she hummed in the picture.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show on the bill. Were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs. Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody which had been done by many people in vaudeville called Airly Airly. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl. And he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her, which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week. And she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition, and the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening, because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out. And some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years, and in 1941 was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You.
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein. And there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralphie wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus. And it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I did in recorded on the record. And I think it's it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it? Composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You. You know, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Yeah. Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listening, the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, how about you? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Reed. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
We're listening to a 1990 interview with composer Burton Lane, who died yesterday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Burton Lane, the composer of many great songs, including How About You, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, You're My Thrill, and On a Clear Day. He died yesterday at the age of 84. You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Harburg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love, I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, I would sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric, or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. But most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think you they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Did this new record with Michael Feinstein bring you out of retirement?
I've never retired.
I wasn't sure about that.
Well, I'm sure. I've never stopped writing. I've always kept writing. And I think it's important. I remember once during the Depression when things were rough, or actually it was a recession in Hollywood, and it was so discouraging to sit down and write because I couldn't get a job. And I remember when I finally did get one, it was very difficult to start the creative juices flowing. And I think it's just like an athlete. You must keep in shape. And so when I've learned that lesson, I've never stopped writing. In fact, on the album, there are a couple of new songs. And I'm very proud of those songs.
Was there a period where you felt that Broadway or musical movies had changed sufficiently so as to kind of leave you out?
No, I don't think so. One of my problems has been finding a lyric writer that I could really team up with. I remember many times I tried to convince Yip Harburg that when you're a team, you grow together, you have a continuity of work together, and I think that's important. All one has to do is look at the careers of Richard Rodgers, who had a long career with Larry Hart, and then when that broke up and Larry died, he had Oscar Hammerstein. And it was after Oscar died that Dick was in the same situation that most of us are in, who don't have a team. He wrote with many writers, never really found a mate, so to speak. So that's one of the problems that I personally have, is not having a steady lyric writer.
But you'd like to have one if you could.
Oh, yes, I would, sure.
I should ask you before we wrap up, how did this collaboration between you and Michael Feinstein happen?
Well, it was Michael's idea. He came to me with this idea. We have been friends. Actually, I knew that Michael had worked for Ira Gershwin, but I never had a chance to meet him until there was a memorial service for Ira in New York, and Michael was there, and I met him that day, and we became friends. And when he would come into New York, we'd meet and spend a couple of hours together around a piano. He would sing, I would play, and it was Michael's idea that I join him in an album. And I said, well, Michael, you know, you do so well for yourself when you're playing. Why do you need me? He said, well, this is what I'd like to do. And that's how it happened.
Is this album changing your life in any way?
I think it's on the verge of changing it. I appeared at the Golden Theater on three occasions. Michael had asked me to do this. And the reaction of the audience was so overwhelming that it kind of shook me up. One of the things I realize is that when we write songs that people like, that those songs are making friends for us, and we as the writers don't know who these people are until we appear before them. And it was just an amazing experience.
Burton Lane recorded in 1990. He died yesterday at the age of 84 after a stroke. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Judy Garland.